In the 1st century BCE, when Edinburgh was no more than a small hill fort, there lived in Rome an engineer architect called Marcus Vitruvius Pollio, a name now generally shortened to Vitruvius. A polymath, Vitruvius designed siege engines for Caesar's army and oversaw the construction of forts, barracks, aqueducts, and civic buildings. He wrote 10 books on architecture, and in them he stressed the importance of achieving a pleasing proportion between different aspects of a building. To Vitruvius, the ultimate perfection of proportions was to be found in the human body itself, and he therefore made careful measurements of the relative sizes of body parts. He found, for example, that the distance from the elbow to the end of the hand is a quarter of a man's height. The length of a foot is a sixth of a man's height. The length of an ear is a third of the length of the face, and so on. There are 13 Vitruvian rules in all, and while it must be understood that they refer to averages and not to absolute invariance, they inform the work of artists to this day. They also raise important questions for scientists. Why are the proportions of body parts generally so predictable? How do organs and parts always seem to end up just big enough to serve one another's physiological needs? Why, more simply, is your left arm about the same size as your right arm? And why in some people does the control of body part size fail? In many aspects of medicine, truths about how normal bodies work are discovered most easily by study of people whose bodies are abnormal. In the case of size control, this means people who are unusually small or unusually large. Large, in this case, means that even their skeletons are large. The largeness that comes with obesity is different, although this too tells us something important about size control, as we'll see later. Even the most cursory study of unusually large and unusually small people reveals that abnormalities of size can be divided into two broad classes. Some such people have bodies that, although of unusual size, still respect the Vitruvian rules, so that if someone showed you a photograph of a silhouette without any other object to indicate scale, it would not be obvious that they are unusual. They are, to use a cliché, small but perfectly formed. The other class of size outliers does not respect Vitruvian rules, typically having limbs that are much shorter than one would expect from the size of the body. These two classes of remarkable people have provided the scientific world with very useful insights into how body size and proportions are controlled. The field is still relatively unexplored, and we still have a great deal to learn, but the rest of this podcast will summarise key features of our current understanding. Very large individuals provided physiologists with their first glimpse of how human growth is normally regulated. Some rare humans, born to normal parents, can reach over twice normal adult height. Individuals over 12 feet tall having been recorded, that's 3.6 metres in new money. These giants were still approximately Vitruvian in proportion, but they had one common classical internal abnormality, a tumour of the pituitary gland, that caused secretion of much higher amounts of hormones than was normal. One important secretion from the pituitary is growth hormone, which is released in pulses. People who grow to be giants have high amounts of circulating growth hormone. Conversely, people who make very little growth hormone are short, often as little as 4 feet. They too are basically Vitruvian. It is important to notice that the observation that high growth hormone is associated with tall stature and low growth hormone is associated with small stature is in itself just a correlation. There is nothing in these facts alone that prove that growth hormone determines final stature, and one could equally well imagine that stature controls how much hormone the pituitary releases. I stress this point because making mere correlation for proof of causation remains a depressingly common error in medical research, and it is very important that you always ask, when reading of a new research finding, whether you're seeing mere correlation or see real evidence of cause and effect. There is good evidence that growth hormone regulates size, but it comes from an additional observation that has to be added to the ones I've already told you. If slowly growing children who have low growth hormone are injected with extra, their growth returns to normal. This does demonstrate true cause and effect. We now know that most cells do not respond to growth hormone directly. Rather, a few cells, particularly a type of cell in the liver, measure the amount of growth hormone that reaches them, and they secrete insulin-like growth factor, or IGF, in response. There are two types of IGF, IGF-2 operating mainly in fetal life and IGF-1 more postnatally. It's important to realise that the description insulin-like has to do with the amino acid sequence of the growth factor's protein and its evolutionary relationships with insulin. IGFs do not have insulin's effect on blood sugar. It follows from the idea that the message about circulating levels of growth hormone is relayed to tissues by IGF-1 that an inability of cells to detect IGF-1 should result in a very small body. This proves to be the case. A rare human mutation exists that renders IGF-1 receptors inactive, and this causes Laronne syndrome, characterized by a very short stature, although the body is still proportioned properly. Interestingly, people with Laronne syndrome tend to be very long-lived, as are experimental animals that showed effective IGF-1 signaling. Some syndromes result in low stature and abnormal proportions. One of the best known is the condition achondroplasia, caused by a mutation that affects the ability of limb bones to grow. This mutation affects limb bones only, resulting in a body shape that has unusual relative proportions, the limbs being far too short to respect Vitruvius's rules. The existence of this body shape makes two important points. The first point is that the failure of limbs to grow normally does not hold the trunk and the head back from their own growth. It is therefore not the case that size control works by every part of a body waiting for every other part to catch up. This has been illustrated clearly by an old animal experiment, in which the growth of one leg of a rabbit was restricted temporarily by interfering with its blood supply, while the other leg was left alone. The control leg grew normally and the experimental leg remained small, resulting in a lopsided rabbit. Even the same types of tissue, therefore, legs in this case, do not wait for each other. More remarkable was a variation on this experiment, in which the experimental rabbit leg was blocked and then released. The released leg now grew faster than the control and pretty much caught up with it. This raises a very interesting question. Clearly, the speed of leg growth cannot be controlled directly by circulating hormones or growth factors, because the fast-growing rescued leg and the control leg whose growth was now slowing down were both in the same body and would be getting the same blood. One could explain this by proposing that a growing limb bone becomes less sensitive to circulating IGF the bigger it has already got. In that case, a limb whose growth had been delayed so was still small would remain more sensitive to circulating IGF than would the leg that had already been growing, so would be able to grow faster and catch up. For many years, this idea remained just that, an idea with no mechanism behind it. But recent discoveries of signalling within growing bones have provided a possible mechanistic explanation. It turns out that the cells deep within the growth plate of a bone, that are responsible for bone growth, need to exchange chemical signals with a thin layer of cells at the edge of the bone. If these signals are strong, the growth is rapid, while if the signals are weak, it's slow, or even stops. The larger a bone has grown, the greater the distance between its core and the layer of cells at the edge, and the less efficient the transmission of chemical signals between the two places. Therefore, bones grow more slowly the larger they already are. When discussing people with achondroplasia and other non-Vitruvian bone growth syndromes, I said there were two important points to take away. The first, that different bones of the body do not wait for each other, has just been dealt with. The second comes from the fact that the short limbs of people with achondroplasia have the right amount of skin to cover them. The problem was in bone growth, but nevertheless, the skin did not go on to form a big bag that would have been right for a normal size leg. Rather, it grew just enough for the abnormally short leg, despite the fact that the skin cells are completely normal and the amount of growth hormone and IGF are also normal. It seems, therefore, that not all tissues are equal when it comes to listening for circulating growth signals. There are some master tissues, such as bones, that set the size of a limb, and other slave tissues, such as skin, that set their own growth according to that of the underlying masters. Thus, skin grows just enough to cover what it is supposed to be covering, which is useful for people who get fat, or pregnant, or whose mammary glands grow at puberty. There are no Vitruvian proportions, by the way, for female mammary glands or the genitalia of either sex. All are highly variable, and it's not uncommon for otherwise small people to have large reproductive organs, and vice versa. The growth of all is controlled mainly by hormones that we'll meet in podcast 6, rather than by hormones that regulate the growth of the rest of the body. Genetic mutation is not the only cause of departures from the normal proportions of body parts. One of the blackest episodes in community medicine occurred during the 1950s and 1960s, when the drug thalidomide was prescribed as a sedative and as a treatment for morning sickness. Many children born to mothers who took thalidomide had severe defects in limb growth, having seal-like paddles and one or more limbs, phocomelia, or even complete absence of a visible limb. We now know, after decades of work, that thalidomide kills developing blood vessels, and that the normal elongation of the limb depends critically on a rapidly advancing internal blood supply. The thalidomide incident resulted in an irreversible change in the trust that the public gave to their doctors. How can a skin cell, a very tiny object compared to the rest of the body, possibly know how much to proliferate in order to cover underlying tissue? Recent experiments in cell culture have suggested a very simple explanation. Skin cells proliferate if they feel a long-term excessive stretch, and they cease proliferating when the stretch is returned to normal levels. In this way, their growth will always catch up with that of underlying bone, or in the case of 21st century humans, an underlying spare tire. There is a great deal to know about size control, and in this audio essay I have only covered a very small part of what's already known. I hope, though, that it's been enough to highlight the questions and to sketch the general shape of emerging answers. There could have been much more detail, but it seemed appropriate to exercise some sense of proportion. Copyright statement. This audio essay by Professor Jamie Davis is to support the first-year MBCHB course at the University of Edinburgh. It is released under the terms of the GNU Public License. It may be distributed freely, but this copyright statement must remain with it, unaltered.